will be in both seconds. Be sure to complete your application as soon as possible. For adding your call to financial aid staff, please be sure to have your student ID ready.
Hello.
Hey TJ. Hey Bill. Hey Jason.
Patterson.
Hello,
Hello. Hi,
hello.
TJ.
Oh, TJ's on the phone. Well, let me professionally blur my background. There. No prying eyes on what my bedroom looks like.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah.
All right. It'll be my first meeting facilitating, so let me know when to go when we're ready.
We're just waiting on one more person to join. And Chuck emailed me, so I'm hoping Chuck joins.
Hey TJ, as long as you're here, thank you again for being a mentor again. Excited to match you. Got very good reviews from your last mentoring. I was going to say performance, but it wasn't a performance. It was real.
You look surprised by that, Mark.
I'm not surprised. I've known you, my friend, for so many years. I know you could provide excellent mentoring, empathy, and good info.
Well, thank you.
So Manuel is joining us, just will be joining us late. Hopefully we'll get a Chuck in here. Do we have anyone else who was excused?
We have Irma who was excused, and Manuel did RSVP, but you did say that he was gonna join us later.
Okay, so we hope to see Chuck then and Manuel later. No one else?
Nope.
I feel like my mind has someone else in this committee. I wonder why that is. Let me just check. My mind has been wrong so many times, so it's not. And it's wrong again. Yep.
I was gonna say Matt Geltmaker, but he didn't RSVP.
Oh, he didn't. Okay, so we are, well, still expecting Matt, and hopefully he will show up instead of being absent. So, okay, so we're expecting three more people. Maybe I will text them.
But
Be right
Thomas
back.
joined.
Oh, yes. Always a pleasure. Ish. I don't think we have quorum without at least one. Do we have quorum? Oh, see, so Irma, we can assume will be granted her LOA, so we can subtract that. So that leaves, let's see, one, two, three. So we don't really have quorum. Then no, we do, because the only people that we're missing are, no, we don't, because it's six people. We're missing three. So we need one more for quorum. So if we, you don't mind, Na and Kira, if we could just give it another minute. And
Thomas, if you were trying to talk, no one could hear you.
Great. Can you hear me now? I was trying to be sassy to Mark, but so sorry you all missed it.
Oh, you sound really far away, Thomas.
Interesting. Oh. I put my headset off.
Nope.
Not better. Better, better? Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
I think this, as it moves up and down, it, I don't know what it is.
Jason, it's nice to see you in that lovely PRC cement wall in the background. I know that wall well.
It's good to see you too. Good to see you too. Yeah, I just own the industrial background. I don't blur it. You guys can see where we're working.
Well, I texted Chuck and Matt, and even though we don't have quorum, we do have at least three council members and friend of the council, Bill Bloom. No, actually council member, just a non-voting one. So I think with four, we can go ahead and start, and hopefully we'll have two people join us, and certainly Manuel will be joining us eventually.
Sure. So I call this meeting to order at 3:05. We'll start with roll call, right? Mark or Kira, can you do the roll call?
Sure.
Or do I do that?
we can do it. No worries. So we'll do members, then staff, then guests. TJ Lee Miyake?
Here.
Na Lee?
Here.
Thomas Noble?
Present.
Bill Bloom?
Present.
Chuck Adams? Chuck is connecting to audio, but looks like they're joining us. And I'll point out that Thomas Noble, although not a member of this committee, is welcome, as all council members are welcome at all committees. Now we'll go council staff, Mark Molnar, Kira.
Kira, council staff.
Jason.
Jason Sinkmeyer's guest.
Aaron.
Aaron Wilson, here from the Center for Public Health Research.
Thank you all.
Okay, great. So next is a review of the draft agenda. Do you want me to share my screen, or Kira, do you want to do that? Okay, thank you.
All right, can everyone see this?
Yes. Looks like we have two presentations today. Any edits to the agenda? Okay, we'll approve by consensus. Next, we'll review the draft minutes from our last meeting on January 9th.
All right, this one, I'm not sure if it was a short meeting that day. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was, we reviewed a couple of presentations.
All right, any edits to the minutes? Okay, they'll be approved by consensus as well. Next on the agenda is announcements. Any announcements from council members? Okay, no announcements. We'll move on to public comment. Anything from the public? All right, we're breezing on through this agenda. And now the exciting part is Medi-Cal expansion presentation. So I'll leave it over to Jason to start the presentation. Thanks.
So I wasn't quite sure. Hi, Jason Sinkmar is Managing Legal Director from PRC. And I was asked about Medi-Cal expansion and how it's affected in 2024. I wasn't quite sure how you wanted to sort of review this or if you just wanted me to present it like I would normally. What's your preferences?
I think if you are able to share screen on your side, you can quickly go through a slide deck if you have it. If you don't have a slide deck, you can just sort of verbally go over what you think you're going to talk about. If you do have a slide deck, there's no need to go into detail about each slide. You could literally just do like, this slide is about this. Moving on.
Sure. Okay. I have a slide deck, so I will go ahead and share that if I have permission. I can do this. Sorry, the switch between Zoom and Teams is always a challenge. All right. So one thing I actually do want some feedback on is you'll see in the as I go through this that there's a kind of a natural break in what the changes are and kind of an overview of where Medi-Cal is. So please feel free to let me know. And if there's anything that needs to be further explained or needs some more information, please don't hesitate to take a note and let me know as well. The basic objectives of this is to talk about the two major changes to Medi-Cal eligibility in 2024 and then explain briefly where we are in the continuous coverage unwinding from the public health emergency, a brief description of what Medi-Cal is, a brief description of the difference, the two different sides of the programs for Medi-Cal being traditional and expanded, MAGI or non-MAGI, and how the new changes are going to impact each one of those. For the asset test, which is the first big change, the asset test has been eliminated starting in January of 2024. This has been a couple year process through the California legislature that has allowed members who used to have only a $2,000 limit go up to $130,000, and now there is no limit for resources. I can go into more detail about what counts as resources, but generally it's money in the bank, cash on hand, inheritance that you haven't spent yet. This all applies only to the non-MAGI programs, which we'll get into in a bit. I can go really fast. The other Medi-Cal update that happened in January 2024 was called the Ages 26 to 49 Adult Expansion, which officially expanded Medi-Cal, full-scope Medi-Cal, to all California residents, regardless of immigration status. This now means that any Californian who's otherwise eligible and meets the requirements of the disability program or of Medi-Cal income limits is eligible for Medi-Cal. They estimate that over 700,000 people will be eligible for healthcare under this program. One of the major concerns about this program, especially with anything with immigration, is about public charge. And it has been confirmed that applying for Medi-Cal and Medi-Cal benefits will not affect your immigration status and does not count as public charge. This is all part of California's expansive Healthy California for All. You can see some of the other programs that have been approved over the past 4 or 5 years. So we are now at the point where it's pretty much full scope, unrestricted Medi-Cal for anyone who meets the eligibility criteria of those programs, which now means that immigration status is no longer considered. All right, moving on to kind of the ongoing public health emergency unwinding. This started back in April of 2023, and where it's really trying to reestablish Medi-Cal eligibility for all the work that kind of got built up over the public health emergency. What happened then is they had said that there would be no negative actions taken against anyone who was on Medi-Cal, so you couldn't really be terminated unless it was for a valid reason. This started back in April of 23, and as you can see, we've just gotten out of the Covered California open enrollment period, so we are now kind of in the tail end of the process. You can go into more details about what the actual date range is for, but this is for people who would be due in February are right around here. People are still eligible to get into Covered California, and if necessary, we can talk about the process a little bit more. But really, there are ways for people to stay covered even if they're redetermined and found not to be eligible for Medi-Cal. Part of the unwinding, as I mentioned before, was no negative actions. And so during COVID, the public health emergency, they said you couldn't be terminated for any of these factors here, which are basic general termination factors. It was all right if you were to terminate, if you passed away, if you were no longer resident of California, or administrative error, or you asked to be discontinued. So folks who had jobs, maybe didn't have a job, got a job during COVID, and then continued to work, weren't automatically terminated unless they asked to be. And so this is what Medi-Cal is trying, and Medicaid programs across the country are trying to fix and unwind as part of the end of the public health emergency. This is just a chart of a bit of the process that goes through, that Medi-Cal is supposed to go through as they recertify and redetermine Medi-Cal beneficiaries. And then if they're ineligible, help them transfer to private insurance. So what you can see is as they go through the process, you know, they have to respond. If they don't respond, they may be terminated. If they do respond and are no longer eligible, then they'll be eligible for Covered California. Covered California has taken steps to allow that enrollment to hopefully be quick. And the clients may have a premium. And so we like to note here that people who are living with HIV can enroll in ADAP and have those premiums, those Covered California premiums covered by the ADAP program, OAHIP, or EBHIP if they have a job. In California, it's estimated that as of November 2023, approximately 14, almost 15 million people are on Medi-Cal of some kind. That's about 38% of the population. In San Francisco alone, about 30% of the population is also on Medi-Cal. So this is a very important program, and that's why it's taken so long for the number of people that they're trying to deal with. Every month, but they're a few months behind, Medi-Cal provides us information about how the redeterminations are going, just to give us an idea of the numbers that they're dealing with on a state and local level. Here in San Francisco, they're looking at, you know, determinations to date. You can see the numbers there. Predominantly, they're one of people, MAGI, meaning they're folks who are over income. So they just make too much money to be eligible for the free full scope Medi-Cal. Most of them are procedural disenrollments. So it's just them going through the process, finding out the client, the beneficiary has too much in assets, and then really helping them to disenroll and move on to another program. These are some of the flyers that we've been using around the city to help people remember to stay enrolled in their Medi-Cal, if you see these around. Also, the Medi-Cal packet is now about 40 pages and it comes in a yellow envelope. So it's an intimidating amount of paperwork for clients and regular community members. So our encouragement is, you know, take a moment. If you see a yellow envelope, look in it, don't just throw it away, but be sure to open it and respond to it because it could impact your healthcare, your client's healthcare, your family's healthcare. At this point, I was not sure how far I wanted to go into whether or not people wanted more background on what qualified as the Medi-Cal programs, what the various ones are that people are eligible for. This sort of depends on the audience understanding of what Medi-Cal programs consist of. So the traditional non-MAGI programs are going to be SSI-linked Medi-Cal, so Social Security income, age blind and disabled program, which is a program for people who are over 65, blind or disabled. They're very creative with the names. The Working While Disabled program, which is a 250% of the federal poverty level, which allows beneficiaries to have a higher income, and then medically needy share of cost. The big change in all of this is, of course, that there are no resource limits for any of these non-MAGI, i.e. traditional Medi-Cal programs, and you just have to be a California resident. Immigration status no longer matters. Just a brief breakdown of what the difference is between the programs. Obviously, age blind disabled, as I mentioned, it's a managed care plan, which they all are. The income limit for this is 130% of the federal poverty level. In 2024, that amount is around $1,700 per month for an individual. So if they're making more than that, they're not eligible for this program. They're also not eligible for Medi-Cal in general because of their income, but not because of the resources. The 250% working disabled program is an excellent program for individuals who are under a disability, but who are interested in doing some level of work or have income above 138% of the federal poverty line. This allows clients to make a little over $3,000 a month And it does not count their SSI benefits. So, I mean, disability benefit amounts. So this is a really great program for folks who may have a side job, who may need to make a little more money to make their rent, or for people who just have SSDI or making more money and have like, you know, check someone's mail. The work definitions are really loose. You can check someone's mail once a month, get paid $20 and it counts as work. And again, this is really great now that there's no asset or resource restrictions because clients can actually save and build money. The monthly premium is on a sliding scale, but it's still set to zero as of the last time I checked. Medically Needy with Share of Cost is the worst program that Medi-Cal has to offer, but it's still considered a non-MAGI program. And what it does is there still is, clients have to pay up to a certain amount before Medi-Cal will kick in. That amount assumes a maintenance level of only $600 a month for each beneficiary, each client. And so if someone's making $1,800 a month, Medi-Cal doesn't kick in to cover their medical costs until the client pays out $1,200, assuming that they can live on only $600 per month. That's a terribly low maintenance level for anyone in the Bay Area. And is also there's active lobbying for legislation to change this amount. But for now, it's still that very low amount. What is MAGI? We talked about it already. We've talked about it a lot, but never really defined it. MAGI is Modified Adjusted Gross Income. And for MAGI Medi-Cal, it's only based on income. You don't have to be disabled. It's just how much do you bring in per month. Medi-Cal is a month-to-month program. So for a single adults who are 19 to 64 now, they just have to be a California resident. There's no resource test. And their income just has to be below the $1,732 per month. Oh, and they can't be eligible for Medicare. What qualifies as modified adjusted gross income? MAGI calculations are a little involved, but generally speaking, it's your adjusted gross income off your tax return plus a couple of other benefits, non-taxable Social Security, tax-exempt interest, and excluded foreign income. We don't really see these very often. For most beneficiaries and clients. One thing about all the Medi-Cal programs is they're now under what's considered managed care plans. This was a big change last year. And so there are only two healthcare options, are San Francisco Health Plan or Anthem Blue Cross. So there's been a lot of confusion about what a managed care plan is. There's no longer just saying I'm under Medi-Cal. It's I'm Medi-Cal under San Francisco Health Plan or I'm Medi-Cal under Anthem Blue Cross. Clients who have been forced to switch have 60 days to make the change. They're still kind of in the redetermination process, making sure everyone's covered under this. And this is just a brief list of things that are covered under MAGI Medi-Cal. These are all of the items that were covered under the ACA for any Medicaid program, plus a lot more. California really is focusing on maternity, newborn care. Dental services is never going to be sufficient. But they are increasing their mental health services, and also substance use disorder services are included in California. There are a number of resources available online brought to you by the Health and Human HIV Health Services Department, courtesy of Andy Scheer, maintains a couple of really good resources that have, you know, HIV care options, HIV benefit options, and also what the new income thresholds are. I obviously could not find a new one of this because it's just the new income thresholds just came out this month. And if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to EAT. We're happy to help providers. We're happy to help beneficiaries. And you can reach out to me directly or call my or email my team and someone will get back to you. Obviously, that was a little faster than I would normally go. Did you get all that?
Yes, and love it. I love how in detail it was. And I also like how swift you were reviewing it. That's great.
Thanks.
While folks consider what they might have as far as questions or comments, just to let you know, we'll probably give you about 45 minutes on the agenda, half hour for the presentation, 10 to 15 or so for any Q&A, which you can take at the end. Or all along. It's really up to you.
Right.
Okay, Thomas? You're Thomas, on mute, though, Thomas.
Thanks. Can you all hear me okay? What's for this on our end?
This was a suggestion from co-chair's meeting, I think, actually, from Bill Balloon specifically, I think. But I the February agenda and the January agenda were basically spelled out for me by co-chairs. I think co-chairs. Certainly you and Bill were both at that meeting and provided me suggested places to go for presentation. So look to thyself.
Thomas, that was me who made the suggestions. It was that and biomedical kind of changes on the horizon.
Okay, that's helpful. Jason, in my world, I feel like the folks who are undocumented seems to be the most hip, like the thing that's got a lot of energy around it.
Okay.
Right? And so, and I don't know if that's I think I got lost a little bit in what we're trying to do is push out that messaging and really work against the fact that people are really concerned about having a public charge on their records and that jeopardizing their potential citizenship. So, but that's my own personal in the circles that I move through, that seems to be the thing that is the hot topic and something that we can get behind. And specifically for Latino MSM and the concept of not thinking of themselves as being able to afford PrEP. So that helps, like whatever you can do to kind of lift that up, just that expansion to undocumented folks and that there is no public charge associated with accessing healthcare. I don't know how to say that, but.
Yeah, no, I didn't breeze over. I have two slides on that and I kind of went a little quick on it just because public charge can get emotionally invested, but I will build that out a little bit, at least in what I discuss about it, so that cool. There's a little more meat there. That's not a problem.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for Jason?
So did that extra part, did the breaking down of the Medi-Cal program seem excessive and outside of the scope of what you were expecting, or did that feel okay as part of the presentation? I know that was one of the things I was concerned about.
I thought it was fine. Kind of covered the highlights and, you know, people could ask questions further if they wanted to, but a lot of us have experience with this.
Yeah, maybe depending on how much time you have left, if you know, you'll always have handouts, right? So maybe you can defer the service providers that need to know the details to the handouts, and then there can be more time for the discussion about public charge and some of those other concerns if you start running out of time.
Okay.
All right, any last questions for Jason? Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thank you.
And we'll send you the draft agenda so you'll know exactly where you land on the agenda. Probably Thursday afternoon or evening or Friday.
All right, sounds good. Thank you all very much. It's a pleasure seeing you, and I will tap out.
Thanks. All right. Are we ready to move on, even though we're going a little fast? Erin, are you ready for the presentation?
I am.
Great.
Thanks for doing this, Erin.
Y'all can see my screen?
Yep.
Okay. Just in case folks need it. All right, so thanks for the invite, y'all. Thanks for Thomas for letting you all know that we have our NHBS data set, preliminary data set, ready for sharing. And this is our unit does population-based studies of populations who may face unmet need and elevated risk for HIV. And it's our CDC behavioral surveillance. So different from our core surveillance and more of going out into the community to survey people and offer them rapid testing to monitor our epidemic. So we do this cycle once, usually every 3 years. It got a little funky with COVID. So we did data collection in 2021, which I'll talk a little bit about. Okay, so here we go. So just so you know how we collected these data, our amazing team went out and identified venues. So places where men who have sex with men might go out to socialize and congregate, meet other people. So on the left, you can see Kurt Williams, our project coordinator, was going out to softball games. So teams are a venue, as well as traditional brick and mortar venues like Moby Dick, where you see the team on the other side there. So we collected these data using a universe of 39 venues. It took us 25 weeks to reach our sample size. We attended a total of 81 events, so almost 14 events a month that we were going out late at night in the grind, in the cold, with our jackets and our heaters. And people were gracious enough to work with us to be surveyed and rapid tested. And so just so you all know, the latest eligibility criteria as determined by CDC is that folks have to be adults, so 18 years of age or older. The CDC area in which the data capture is San Francisco or San Mateo residents. So in theory, people could be from San Mateo. Most of our venues, all of our venues were in San Francisco. So we didn't capture any, I don't think, folks from San Mateo. New for this year, which is why it's highlighted, we collected data with folks who had a male sex at birth and identified as a cis man or non-binary. CDC was also inclusive of the first time of transmasculine folks. So people who are non-binary and people who had a female sex at birth who identified as men. So as you can see, the sample size was predominantly cisgender men who have sex with cis men. That was 538 people, including that group as non-binary folks, and then transmasculine folks, there were 9. Eligibility includes they have to have ever had sex with men. They had to be able to complete the survey. So alert and capable. We offered it in English and in Spanish, and we had to make sure folks didn't participate in it more than once. Of note, and I'll talk about why I mentioned this a little bit later, in all of our local analyses, we include everybody that participated in the study. However, CDC, when they come out with their big morbidity and mortality weekly report, they usually do a whole cadre of studies using the data set from the 23 sites across the nation that collect these data at the same time with the same community. They will not include people who have not had sex recently in their analysis. So folks who haven't had sex recently, we will include in our analysis. They won't in their national analysis. So here is who we recruited. Again, the sample size ended up being 545 people. As you can see here, most identified as cis men who have sex with cis men, but we did have quite a few non-binary folks, 33, which made up 6% of our sample. And we did have 9 trans men participate as well, so 2% of our overall sample. There was 1% who identified as heterosexual, but most identified as gay, and a smaller proportion at 11% identified as bisexual. We had some good age diversity, you know, around 20 to 30% of each age group, although the 50 plus was the biggest group. As far as race, ethnicity, we feel like we got a pretty decent spread. So we had 10% of the sample identified as Asian, Native Hawaiian, or Pacific Islander, 8% as Black or African American, almost half as white, 32% as Hispanic or Latino, and 5% identified as other, and that could have been a combination. Often it's folks who identify with multiple races or ethnicities. A good spread on education, a generally highly educated group, as you can see, you know, more than 50% of folks had a bachelor's degree or postgraduate studies. So a lot of education in the group. As far as occupation, most folks worked full-time. The only other, you know, second biggest group was 14% identified as unemployed. Almost 10% were retired. There were some students, a few part-time workers. And we are not surprised by the income spread that we had, you know, 36% of folks identified as making an income of $100,000 a year or more. And another 35% between that $40K to $100K. So highly educated, pretty decent incomes as well. Most folks said that they had health insurance, and almost 90% said they had a usual source of care. Almost 90% also said they recently, or at least in the last year, saw a healthcare provider. And in the past year, a little more than 50% said that their provider offered them an HIV test. So when we look at prevalence, we like to look at trends over time. We could probably go back in the Wayback Machine and look at this over time, but we didn't see any big uptick or downtick. It looked like the HIV prevalence was relatively stable to the last time we collected data, which was venues, but it was in the world of COVID. So the venues were online, so it's a little bit different. But the samples are quite similar, and we can see that the prevalence is also quite similar. So no major change when it comes to HIV prevalence. This is kind of a complicated table, so stick with me for it. So one thing that we ask in the NHBS is we first ask folks to self-report their HIV status, and then we provide rapid tests. And for the most part, how people self-report is consistent with their rapid test result, but sometimes it's not. So we had the three folks who reported that they were negative when they entered the study and they tested positive for HIV. So we would consider those people who were newly tested positive for HIV. Most folks who were living with HIV knew that. A few folks said that they didn't know their HIV status, but all of those folks tested negative for HIV. We asked a question about how long folks had been living with HIV. So this is an average. Of course, it could skew with big outliers, but the average was 18 years with a standard deviation of about 10 years. Six people tested positive for HIV in 2023. So that includes the three who said in the last year they tested positive, and then the three new people who newly tested positive in our study. So we would consider those all folks who had newly tested positive in 2023. And this sex gender table is a little bit different now that we're inclusive of non-binary folks and transmasculine folks. So this is looking at sex and gender by their self-reported HIV status, whether they knew they were living with HIV, and whether or not they newly tested positive for HIV. And so as you can see, all the folks who newly tested positive for HIV identified as cis men who had sex with cis men. So none of those folks who newly tested positive were
non-binary.
Yeah, you know, I'm just like, I just want to get done, you know, and get out of the way.
I know.
Manuel, can you mute yourself?
Take your time.
Thanks.
All right. Okay, so by group, you can see it's a, you know, there's a spread that we would expect to see that the folks who knew they were living with HIV increased over time, as we would expect. And then those who were, you know, known positives, there were seven in that 18 to 29 group, but by the time too, we get the folks who were 50 plus, 72 folks knew they were living with HIV. So this is nothing really surprising in the HIV outcome by age group. And again, by race ethnicity, this is where we start to see things are a little bit different. We see that there were 51 folks who self-reported that they were not living with HIV, and they tested negative as well. And no new positives in that group, but the folks who tested newly positive, who were all MSM,
were across three different groups. One was African American or Black, another was a white, and another was Hispanic or Latino. So nobody in the API group and nobody in the other group was in that newly tested positive group. And then this issue comes up for us because we looked at sexual activity. So again, CDC won't look at folks who are not considered sexually active in the last year. And so as you can see that folks who are not sexually active, quite a few of them are known to be living with HIV. So I think it's a real, it's potentially really problematic for CDC to not be looking at these folks in their analyses, because of course we want to look at the HIV care cascade, their access to ARTs and their viral suppression. And if we exclude them from these analyses, we won't be able to see that. So this is really just to kind of point out that yes, there are 20 folks who are living with HIV who are not currently sexually active, but their data wouldn't be captured in that CDC data going forward. So we will be sure to pay attention to those folks and make sure we're measuring their access to care and their utilization and viral suppression going forward. Here's our cascade we all love so much because it gives us a nice visual of what's happening with the HIV care cascade for all of those who tested positive in NHBS. So again, that sample is 132 people. And as you can see, the raw numbers are these bottom white numbers, the top are the percentages. So we look at this non-nested version of the HIV care cascade. You can see that almost 100% of folks knew they were living with HIV. You know, again, almost 95% were on medications and almost 90% were undetectable viral load by self-report. So I think a stellar job in the HIV care cascade. I think San Francisco's doing excellent. I'm sure this looks much higher than our other peers in other cities will be able to show. When we nest this, so I think we are close to meeting these 95, 95, 95 targets in San Francisco. So when we nest them, meaning looking at how many people are on ARTs of those who knew they were living with HIV. And again, looking at folks who report an undetectable viral load among those on ART, we get an even higher 98, 96, 92. So we're almost to that kind of home run final frontier, I think, in the HIV care cascade with the community. So I think that's exciting news to see those data. And then when we kind of look at, okay, who is living with HIV currently, we can see again that it's mostly, it was inclusive of MSM with different gender identities. It's mostly MSM who were living with HIV in our study sample, but of course there were some folks living with HIV who identified as non-binary and as trans men. The real difference we saw in age and that we saw that much fewer 30 to 39 year olds were living with HIV than living without HIV than living with HIV. The reverse is true for those age 50 and older, that many more were living with HIV than not living with HIV. So we know that the world has changed for a long period of time. It'll be interesting to see how this shakes out over time if these differences persist within age groups. We also continue to see this disparity here that relative to the number of folks surveyed in the study, we still see disparities in HIV positivity among Black African Americans. We see disparities in that those with less education are more likely to be living with HIV, and those who have less income are more likely to be living with HIV. I think these are not surprises for us, but they continue to resonate that social determinants are really important and our racial disparities persist. And again, this is the stickler point I'm quite stuck on is looking at sexual behaviors by HIV status. So again, those who are not sexually active, I think this is in the last year, folks who say that they aren't sexually active in the last year, there are, you know, disproportionately more are living with HIV. So again, really important for us on our side to do our own advocacy around their inclusion in looking, especially at the HIV care cascade, but across all analyses to make sure that sexual activity is not the eligibility criteria for being a part of these analyses, which I think requiring that somebody is sexually active also doesn't look at drug use and what risks folks might be experiencing related to sharing equipment or something related to substance use. So just a point of advocacy for us. We also see differences in those who've engaged in sex work, and I believe this measure is ever, so that we see those who have engaged in sex work, there's a higher proportion who are living with HIV. And then this is a combined prevention and care measure, but among those who are basically engaged in biomedical prevention or care, we see that there are a lot of folks who are living with HIV that are highly engaged in their ART, and there might be less engagement in PrEP, and we'll see a little bit more of that as we continue on. So we'll get to the PrEP in a second, but before that, we're looking at HIV testing. Generally, there aren't major differences in HIV testing in the past year among those who were negative or status unknown by self-report in 2023. The only real difference here is that we see fewer folks 50 plus getting tested for HIV in the last year. I don't think there are any major differences by race, ethnicity, or education. We see something kind of on the precipice of significance here in education, but there might be fewer people with lower education that didn't get a test, but nothing that's significant. And then here is our PrEP cascade for 2023. So again, these bottom numbers in the white are the absolute numbers, and the top numbers in black are percentages. So among those who are HIV negative, 98% were aware of PrEP, so they had ever heard of PrEP. And 60% had discussed PrEP with a healthcare provider in the past 12 months. And in the past 12 months, 57% had used PrEP. So, you know, much better than the rest of the country. I think we might want to look at trends over time. And so we wanted to also just present this comparing to 2021 data. So as you can see, there are fewer people who discuss PrEP with their healthcare provider in the last 12 months, and fewer people who have used PrEP in the last 12 months. So we're kind of doing a deep dive on this right now to understand better what the difference is and who's using PrEP less, and getting really into the nitty gritty of more of the distinctions around the PrEP data. But it does appear like there's, compared to 2021, there's less use of PrEP. So this is the kind of the non-nested model. We're not looking at percentages within other percentages. So I also just was kind of curious about, when you look at among those who are aware of PrEP, how many discussed it with their provider, and that number is 61% of those who are aware of PrEP had discussed it with their provider. The good news is almost 100% of those who had discussed PrEP with their provider are using PrEP or have used PrEP in the last 12 months. And of those folks who have used PrEP in the last 12 months, 85% have used it in the last 30 days. And then there's kind of this, we don't know quite what to make of this, but it looks like there's a big drop off. So there are a lot of folks who are talking about with their provider, the provider's getting them on PrEP. They've used it in the last year. They may have even used it in the last month, but at the time that we surveyed, they were not currently on PrEP. So it could be that people are using 2-in-1. And so at this moment that we surveyed them, we didn't catch them currently on PrEP. Or there could be some issues around persistence that we want to look more closely at. What are the barriers to persisting on PrEP for folks? And do they even want to persist on PrEP? So I think this is a question we want to look at in more depth. We did have one question from CDC where we asked why folks stopped taking PrEP. And for folks who answered that question, they said they were not at risk for HIV infection anymore. Some folks were concerned about side effects. And I know in 2023, a lot of the ads were coming out around the Gilead lawsuit. So I don't know if that impacted people's awareness around side effects or concerns. We had a few folks say they didn't like taking medications. A few folks say that they couldn't afford it anymore. And then there were other responses. So those others kind of run the gamut, but they include, I'm a biochemist major, and so I'm not taking PrEP anymore. all the way to, I was way too promiscuous on prep. Another person said they didn't want to go for the blood work. Another person said after the pandemic, it was hard to get in the routine of going to see their provider. Another person said they were now in a monogamous relationship and felt they didn't need prep. And other folks said that they had issues with their medical provider. So I think this persistence question, I think we all know that's the a really important question that we're all wrestling with. Tried to kind of mirror this against the HIV case surveillance, just at, in the very least at like the colors. So also looking at PrEP a little bit more in depth by race, ethnicity. So as you can see by these colors here, things look great around awareness. And then we start to have this fall off on those who discuss PrEP, with Black, African-American, MSM reporting the lowest rates of discussing PrEP with a healthcare provider. But interestingly, this percentage is the same. So it seems like every African-American man who talked to their provider about PrEP got on PrEP. The issue might really be at this discussing PrEP with a healthcare provider stage. So that might be a point of intervention to think about. As far as those who are on PrEP, it's the highest among folks who identify as other, followed by those who identify as Hispanic, Latino, followed by Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander folks, followed by Hispanic, Latino folks, and then white people, and then African-American last. But again, this number is comparable, the same between those who discussed PrEP with a provider and those who actually used it in the last year. As a point of comparison, just wanted to include this slide from City Clinic data. Of course, their rates are going to be higher because folks are going there specifically for sexual health needs. But, you know, we see the same kinds of racial disparities when it comes to those who are on PrEP. As far as other prevention engagement, we parsed out the data by those who reported and tested HIV negative and looked at those who were sexually active specifically. And it looks like about 20% said that they always use condoms. 16% said they were using PrEP 2-in-1 and 10% use PEP. So this PEP might be another, I think we see that across communities that there's just generally low PEP awareness in use. And I feel like it's a great tool. I don't know if the healthcare system agrees, but I think getting the word out about PEP is also a potential opportunity. And then, you know, we had a student get into a deeper dive around like DoxyPEP and PrEP use. And we saw that, you know, of course, those who use PrEP were, there were significantly more folks who did not use a condom. That's what we would expect. So we see that. We know that we need to be prepared for that, especially around sexually transmitted infections and rolling out DoxyPEP. So we do also ask folks about preferences for future and existing PrEP options. So we had this kind of hypotheticals around if there was injectable PrEP that was offered that you could take once every 6 months, would you be interested in it? What about an implant? What about daily oral PrEP as a preference? And how about injectable PrEP every 2 months? And this is kind of how it shook out, that when the idea of offering an injectable that lasted 6 months, almost half of folks said that they'd be really interested in that as an option. So I know that's on the horizon. I know hopefully our systems are, you know, getting things in place with the 2 month injectable that will, if it does come out and we can roll it out, it'll be, the system will be ready to implement, but it definitely seems like there's a lot of interest for injectable 6 month PrEP. As far as like awareness around injectable PrEP, there was really high awareness. 66% of folks said they had heard of injectable PrEP. However, only 5 were currently on it. So it seems like we are early on rollout and implementation. It'd be interesting to see how much that changes by the next time we do these this data collection. And interest in the long-acting PrEP every 2 months, which is currently available, you know, more than 60% of folks said that they were somewhat or very interested in this modality of taking PrEP. So lots of interest. It seems like it just hasn't made its way out into the community so much, albeit there's lots of interest. We also asked about barriers and facilitators, what would keep them from taking injectable PrEP or not taking it. And obviously the facilitator, number one, is I wouldn't have to remember to take a pill every day. I think that's known across populations as the big benefit. So these numbers are a little off from the responses. And then also the longer duration than taking a daily pill, and they wouldn't have to worry about losing their pill. So mostly around pill taking and adherence, but the barriers are really interesting. You know, folks talked about side effects. So the biggest proportion of folks, 27%, said that was a potential barrier, was potential side effects, followed by a quarter of folks said it'd be too hard to go to a doctor visit every 2 months. And that was followed by 22% of folks saying they don't want anything injected in their body. So I'm doing research with trans women around injectable prep, and there's very different, similar facilitators, different barriers. So I think it's interesting to think community by community what the potential barriers are. DoxyPep, there was a lot of awareness. I think 67% of folks said that they had heard of DoxyPep. Almost 30% had discussed it with a healthcare provider, and almost 20% had used DoxyPep. So that feels high, especially because it feels like it's early in DoxyPep rollout. Interestingly, we asked folks who had talked to their healthcare provider about DoxyPep, whether they brought the conversation up or the healthcare provider did. And it was almost split even, that half said their provider brought it up, half said they brought it up themselves. And the interest in taking DoxyPep, almost half of folks said that they were interested in taking DoxyPep, and the reasons for folks who weren't, half said that they weren't at risk for STIs. 30% said they didn't really have enough information to take it, and a few were concerned about side effects. And then we kind of looked at like what was associated with DoxyPep usage, who's in the community using it. And we saw that low DoxyPep awareness was associated with older age, African-American, race, less than high school education, and Latino, Hispanic participants had the highest awareness of DoxyPep. So that was really interesting racial differences for awareness. Around sexual behaviors, there was a higher odds of DoxyPep awareness for those who self-reported having an STI and those who had been tested for an STI in the past year. So good on City Clinic and all of our sexual health providers, oops, sorry about that, who are getting the word out when folks are testing for and getting their sexual health services. So that's fantastic. And then PrEP taking participants were more likely to not use condoms, more likely to have had a bacterial STI in the past year, and more likely to use DoxyPep. So it seems like DoxyPep is getting out precisely to communities who could most benefit. And folks who are PrEP users seem to have good awareness and usage of it in the city so far. Long ago, when we were crafting our local questions, MPOX was at a peak or maybe just immediately past the peak. So we wanted to make sure we got some good data on MPOX cascade as far as how many folks had taken a vaccine. And it looks like 413 participants, or 76% of the population, ever had a vaccine. Only 3% had ever had MPOX, and 1% had ever taken any medications. And reasons for not taking MPOX vax among folks that we asked, half of those folks said that they weren't at risk for MPOX, so they weren't concerned about it. And then from there, the barriers were things like they couldn't get an appointment, not enough information, concerned about side effects. But by and far, the biggest concern was really, the biggest barrier was that they just felt like they weren't at risk for MPOX or really concerned about it. Okay, so in summary, much progress, but there is still some work to do. We could see the prevalence is stable. Almost all participants who were living with HIV were aware of their HIV status, and across the board, most folks were aware of their status, whether it was negative or positive. And almost all participants living with HIV were on ART last time they had sex. So that's really exciting progress on the health education front, on the healthcare access front, and more than 90% of MSM self-reported that they were virally suppressed. So big wins, feels like, on the care side. I think some of the, you know, racial disparities still persist in the HIV prevalence. And the group, this group of 30 to 39 year olds, were the least likely to report viral suppression among those living with HIV. So I don't know what's going on with those folks, but as you can see, compared to the rest of the group, that greater than 92% viral suppression, participants in the 30 to 39 age group, it was about 77.3% reported that they were not virally suppressed. So that's something we might want to look further into. And we also, you know, have some work to do on PrEP. Less than half of MSM participants were on PrEP last time they had sex. And PrEP use has declined over time, it appears, since 2021. And PrEP persistence might be one of the biggest challenges, and really understanding that is something we need to do, and then finding ways that we can intervene to address challenges that folks have related to PrEP persistence. That's it. Thanks to our amazing team who did this great work, and happy to take any questions. Yes, Thomas.
More hand clapping more than anything else. So the value of the, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you ish, yes.
I'll just figure out what's going on with the microphone. No, that was just great. So I just wanted to, I was hand clapping and thanking you for the information. So do you know Na already from Marin?
Do you know? No.
Na's the epi lead.
Oh, awesome. Nice to meet you.
No, I'm not an epi lead. I work with our epi team, but I share out their epi results. So it sounds like I'm the lead. They awesome. Do all the work and I present it. Yeah.
I was just more curious about you listening to the presentation and kind of having your understanding of epi work. And you probably could appreciate the complexities of the interviews and the data that is collected. And it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was great. And I want to like sit down and look at the numbers and the data like on my own. But yeah, it's I think there's a lot of tables and numbers. And for the larger group, if anywhere possible, if you're able to put it into like a visual chart for folks, it'll be easier so we can listen to you explain it instead of having to focus on the numbers on the table. I think that's the one piece at the beginning of the presentation.
Yeah, that's great feedback. I'll try to do that. Thank you. And if it's, I'm happy to also cut. I know I'm like a fast talker, so I can get through a lot of data fast, but it might go too fast that it's not useful if folks aren't able to absorb that quickly. So if it's helpful, I'm happy to, you know, kind of wean it down a little bit if there are things that aren't as high priority to folks.
I actually loved all the data. So,
okay. But,
yeah. I did have a couple of questions. With the over 50 plus, you didn't want to possibly break that down a little bit more? Of the survey?
Yeah. No, I don't know if like I would have to look at the data because I don't know if they responded by they were in an age range or they gave an actual specific age. I'd have to go look at the data, but that's a good, you know, that's definitely a great idea. I think there's probably some granularity within it. Do you have a breakdown that might be more helpful?
Well, I mean, what do we use, Mark? What do we do it by every 5 years now? Oh, after 55?
I think we do. Yeah. I don't know offhand, but that sounds familiar.
Yeah. I think that would be helpful. I know that
some
probably asked that question. And then I'm just curious, and I'm just being like kind of crazy here. Sorry. I apologize. Under occupation, can somebody be two different things? Could they be like me, a student and a part-time worker, or, you know, like that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for those questions they had to choose one, so it's just a matter of whether it's like check all or choose one, but I can follow up and add it to the slide just to be clear.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
And then just one little other thing I'm going to ask you, in the education you use some college and then you just jump to a bachelor's degree. I've seen a little bit of research out there that like there's a difference between somebody who's has some college and an associate's, and then like with adherence going up to when they have a bachelor's. So I was just curious if that might be something you guys want to break out. I kind of think.
Yeah, if we have anything more granular, I will check it out. I mean, it's like the way that we get the data, CDC rolls us out all across the country all at the same time, and they give us what we call the core survey, and that's the lion's share of the questions, including all these social determinants questions. And then we get to add a little set of local questions. So sometimes things aren't as we would like them.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you.
We will definitely include for sure.
I'm impressed, TJ, you were paying that close of attention.
Oh, yeah, I was. I
sorry.
I'm a data person.
Right, obviously. I'm like, wow.
I have a quick question. On the slide where you referenced the 95, 95, 95, like the care cascade, I was trying to see that the numbers matched up with the chart that was shown, but it didn't look like the last number was different. So I don't know if I did it, if I was looking at the wrong chart or something. But
yeah, no, it is different. Yeah. So one is like, this is the perpetual problem we have about how to think about cascades that we get all tied up about. So there's the cascade that's not nested. The denominator is the same across all measures. And the 95, 95, 95 indicators are meant to be nested. So among those who, you know, are on ART, how many are virally suppressed versus just among those on ART in the denominator is like all folks living with HIV. So that's a different one. And the nested is, it's in my mind, two very different public health questions. In my mind, the nested one is like within the healthcare system, the people we know, we've identified in surveillance, they're in our care, are we doing a good job? And the non-nested in my mind is, who are all the folks in the community who may not be connected to the system? We also need to understand the care cascade from that perspective, because those people are not, we can't intervene in the system. We actually have to get out to the community and find those folks because they're not connected. So yeah, they are two different things.
That's helpful for me because I didn't know the term, the nested term. That's helpful. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, probably good to make sure to explain that as well at the council.
Sure, yeah.
And as far as timing goes, if the PRC presentation is on the shorter end of 30 to 45, I'll probably put you on the longer end. This is a longer presentation, and it doesn't sound like folks are recommending any cuts. They're actually recommending additions. So there you have it. Thank you.
And just to throw it out there for you all, you know, we like to, and I'll let the council know this as well, you know, people ask us for slices and dices of these data to the, you know, it's capacity based, but if we can ever answer a specific question people have, you know, we're always happy to try to do a sub analysis if that's useful to folks. So, you know, if you all have specific questions that we could look at more in depth, assuming we have those data, questions were asked that could facilitate that, we're happy to do that. This is kind of the big first pass without doing any kind of manipulations.
I'll just say, so I felt that the PrEP injectable data was the most surprising to me. So I really did not think people would, I mean, when the rubber hits the road, that may change, but I really did not think that there would be that significant of a demand. So I was like, good to be wrong every once in a while with my assumptions, but that definitely was present.
Yeah, it was interesting though, Thomas, because there was so little uptake. So I don't know what's going on there.
I just assume it's just too new. So the providers, the LAI thing that Andy did, they just, it's interesting because when I was at the general at the lobby, they're not in a derogatory way, but passing out like candy. They were really kind of trying to get everybody on injectable who was walking through the door, who was negative, and at other places that I don't think it's on their radar at all. So I think that's just, hopefully as it gets on people's radar, that will shift. But it went from being very daunting in my mind very quickly. And then having that experience where it was like, oh, it's just like everything else that you give a shot for.
But I've also heard that it is so painful for like 4 or 5 days afterwards that that's discouraged people from doing it. So if there was a way to, whatever the base is that they use for the shot to make it different, then they would get back on it.
That's what Susan Buchbinder said when somebody said, oh, I wish there was a 6-month shot. They're like, I don't think they realize how painful and how much of a, how much medicine you would need for that. Obviously it didn't, but that's, again, maybe that's why I was surprised by the data, because my experience is like, no, if I don't have to get a shot, I'm not going to. Like I'll push off a flu shot even in my mind just because I, so.
But, yeah, I've heard the same thing with the people get like nodules, you know, of medicine, even just with the 2-month and yeah, the shot itself was really painful. And I think there are still a lot of insurance kinks that have been worked out. So maybe that's part of the problem as well. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, in theory, when you say it, like magic shot protects you for so long. And then, you know, rubber hits the road and you're like, this thing might really hurt to get, and then it hurts for a while afterwards. So that'll be interesting to see next time what this looks like.
And I'm kind of curious if there's any information about the people that wanted to stop taking pills, if they were using some type of reminder, like the, you know, the alarm on the pill cap cover, that sort of thing. I personally don't understand. I've been taking my HIV meds for 24 years. I don't understand. It's the first thing I do before I get out of bed. I don't know how people can forget, you know. I know people can forget, but I guess, yeah, my husband uses the alarm thing and that's great for him. So
yeah, I think that's the psychology of something being prevention oriented is kind of like, well, I miss it. I don't know, it seems like a whole different calculus. That would be interesting.
I struggle with allergy pills. Yeah. It's something that simple. It's like, yeah, every once in a while I miss, so.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, if there's no more questions, then much like with Jason, either Kira or I will send you the draft agenda after it's approved by steering committee tomorrow afternoon. And yeah, any questions for us logistically?
No, thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, y'all.
All right. Is that it for us today, Mark?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All yay. Done. This meeting is adjourned at 4:10.
Actually, can I get your all's input real quick?
Oh, it's been adjourned already, Thomas.
No.
I'm power hungry. Just kidding. Go ahead.
For the Megatrends presentation, I kind of jotted down a few things that I thought I would make sure to include, and I just wanted to run those past you and see if you see if there's anything missing or if anything that you're kind of like, oh, yeah, don't talk about that. So one was just the concept of movement and transition within the health department from like recovering from COVID, basically. That's definitely kind of been a theme for us. Workforce development. The concept of synergy, people seem to be using that word a lot. The word disparity as well. There's just a lot of people use that word. It's not often clearly defined. Doxy prep, cluster detection and response efforts, testing levels, just kind of acknowledging that they're flat is kind of something that is a trend for us. Coordination of services, something that we hear a lot of, and then just long-acting injectable medications is kind of on the radar. Is there anything that you all would want me to add with regards to a trend?
I think if you are going to, so mega trend is more than just local trends, it's mega. And so if you can connect any of those to things that are either coming down nationally or that are happening on a national level, or that national outcomes are impacting us, national initiatives, that would be great. You know, we just definitely, although local trends are definitely important, we don't want a mega trends presentation that doesn't connect to the larger state and even perhaps more importantly, national efforts that might be happening.
Perfect. I think most of that is national, other than the testing levels and then just local coordination of services. So perfect. Any other thoughts before we jump off? Thanks, Mark. Cool. All right. Thank you. All right. See you all in the next meeting space.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Oh, Mark, are you free for a minute?
Yep.
Cool.
Mark, I don't think we have anything to review, so I'll just hop off. Is that okay?
Yeah, just press stop. Oh, no, I'll press stop. This is a meeting. Okay. Right,
bye.
Bye-bye. Let me press stop in case you have something personal. I assume what you're going to be doing is offering to mentor for the Chile program.